Hey, podcast listeners. Okay, so there's this thing in the WFMU record library called the old bin. There's a new bin where all the new music goes for usually 2 or 3 months or so, and then it goes into the library. But there's a thing called the old bin where DJs are encouraged to put some of their favorite things from our library. And the library is so huge, it's impossible to get a handle on all of it. So it's nice to have this thing which gives you access to some of the other DJs' favorite stuff, some of the treasures of our library. And some of the stuff goes back to the 60s, so there's just an endless amount of treasures in this library. So a few weeks ago, I found this record by The Hobbits on the Decca label, and we're about to hear a song off of it. And I thought, who wrote this song? A guy named Jimmy Curtis. He wrote the two best songs on the record. I thought, okay, who is this guy? So I started to dig and found all kinds of odd music by this guy, and I decided, okay, this is a perfect guy to try to track down an interview. He has a website, but it turns out it's not run by him. It's run by a German fan, a super fan, and that was it. There was a dead end. I did find a phone number for him that turned out to be an old phone number that the German super fan had. It was not Jimmy Curtis's phone number, and through a listener who does not want to be thanked used some sort of private detective techniques to track down where Jimmy Curtis was now. And I called him. He was surprised. He doesn't have an email address. And we set up an interview. So we did the interview. And he's, especially in the beginning of the interview, he just didn't have much to say. And he did warm up as it went on, and I think it was quite, I think he was surprised. I think he does not get interviewed ever, so we got to hear the lowdown of this kind of interesting, you know, just one of the many interesting stories of how lots and lots of records got made in the music industry, mostly in the 60s. So I think it's an interesting story. Again, the whole radio program is filled with Jimmy Curtis music. I refer to a lot of it in the interview. So if you want to hear the whole archive, it's over at WFMU.org/Michael. Meanwhile, that's about it. Summer's coming. I know I'm slowing down in the interviews, but I'm just not motivated. I don't know. I'm not sure what's going on. I'm losing the will to live, perhaps. Not really, but to live part of my life. You can always reach me, michael@wfmu.org. Those who contributed to our recent fundraiser, thank you so much. The rest of you, I don't understand you. Here is my chat with Jimmy Curtis. Hope you find it interesting.
In a hollow voice.
right, Jimmy Curtis, good morning and welcome to WFMU. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. We've been listening to a lot of your music this morning. You seem to have ridden out so many changes through the music industry. That's the first kind of thing that's hits my mind when we've listened to all these different records of yours this morning. So your first records came out in the late 50s, early 60s.
I had known someone whose uncle was in the music business, and I had a group of four people, including myself. We had written one song. I gave him a tape of the song, and he gave it to his uncle. And his uncle liked it, called us to come in and sign a contract. We recorded the song. The song was basically a regional hit. And we recorded another song after that, and that was the end of the group.
Was that the MJs?
Yeah, it was the MJs.
So then your solo debut, I think, is 1961 on United Artists. So tell me how you got from guy in college with the guitar to getting signed to United Artists and making records with Don Costa.
Well, what happened was that I went into the advertising business. I became an art director. But at the same time, after I left the office, I always had my guitar at the office. And after 5 o'clock, I would go over to the west side, to where the music companies were. And I would play songs that I had written for different people. And, I had several records, recorded, of my songs. And it came to a point in my advertising career where I just decided to give it up and concentrate completely on the music business. And that's when I went in. I went to Laurie Records. I found an individual who I would write with, and both of us just stayed at Laurie Records and wrote songs.
It's the early 1960s. It's kind of an interesting time for music because there's still this kind of teen sound, this kind of very poppy sound, and then there's this kind of Beatles more band sound coming in, and some of your early stuff is more in that sort of teen thing, and then it's interesting to watch as it evolves into something else. Tell me, when you were at Laurie, I think you mentioned you were just co-writing. I assume that's Ernie Maresca that you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
You and Ernie were writing some very catchy songs. Some, you know, and I'm talking about your What's Happening, Baby, things like that, which have such hooks to them. You're talking about 1965, and to me, they fall very much into the Del Shannon or Gary Lewis and the Playboys or Gene Pitney, that sort of thing of what was happening. So tell me what the scene was like at Laurie and what they thought about the songs that you guys were writing, like Girl from a Thousand Dances, that were, it's like a party record. What were the hopes for you at that label?
I was always a melody writer. I always looked for the hook or the chorus. I always wanted to really make that stand out, and that's what made hits. What made hits and still do is the chorus. So Ernie and I, we wrote several songs. At Laurie, there was another writing team that had really hit songs. One of the writers, I think his name was Greenfield. So you had two factions at Laurie. You had this particular writing combination, and then Ernie and I were writing, but nothing really ever came of it because I wasn't satisfied at Laurie. I had asked them if they would put me on retainer as a writer, and they said no. And that was my cue to, you know, finally think about leaving Laurie and going somewhere else.
Who are the folks who ran Laurie?
They were two brothers, the Schwartz brothers.
Because it was sort of a small indie, but they did, like you said, they did put some records on the charts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did. Lori Records was a fairly small boutique record company, but they had a fairly good number of hits. I was on the outs with the Schwartz brothers because there came a time when I felt that they were not giving me the money that I deserved, and I had a forensic accountant go up there and look at their books, and sure enough, they owed me thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And after that happened, they no longer said hello to me. they didn't want anything to do with me.
Yeah.
So, but that's part of the music business. At that particular time, there were a lot of artists that weren't being paid. I remember meeting Joey Levine on the street, and he had the number one hit in the country at that time. And I said to him, "That's fantastic. You're going to make a lot of money." He says, "No, I'm not making any money because what I owe for my retainers every week, you know, they sign me to write, and every week they take out a certain portion. So I have a number one hit, but I'm not going to make any money."
Yeah.
So that's the way it went then.
Yeah, we've heard that story a few times on this program. But you were placing some songs. Bruce Chanel did a song of yours. The Chiffons recorded a song. Your song, When You Take More Than You Give, was recorded by a bunch of people. We heard Kelly and Gayle's version earlier that came out on Colpix. There's one song from this time, Laughing at the Rain, which sort of to me sounds like The Circle. Or again, it's a very contemporary song for that sort of late 60s AM radio period. Songs like that, like Laughing at the Rain, where were they recorded? Who were the musicians on these things?
New York had the best studio musicians in the country. And but at that time, I was playing the guitar, so I would sit in, on the sessions and play the guitar.
In 67, there's Psychedelic Situation, which kind of the song you're most known for now, and was a big, sort of your biggest hit and a hit regionally. Again, was this recorded in New York City, and is the arrangement on paper, or is it just a head arrangement that the guys in the studio are making up?
Yeah, it was kind of both. Some of the arrangement was done, but also some of the studio playing was just that. At the spur of the moment, you got a feel for how it's going to sound, who's going to play what, and of course, you know, the vocals would come in, and of course, I was singing at, you know, some ridiculous, you know, vocal range for that particular song, but it all. You know, came out and all worked.
And as to the writing, was this kind of move towards psychedelicness, was that reflected in your life, or was it just something that just happened? How did you make that move in terms of the writing and the subject matter?
That was the only song of that kind that I wrote.
Your solo record, Life, you know, by that point, it's very much about current events, and, you know, some of the Hobbit songs, they're much more about current events, and the style is more, definitely less straight pop, you know?
Yeah, Life was introspective. Life was, you know, my take on you know, how I was looking at life and what life had occurred to me.
Well, it's very interesting to watch, as I said, to watch this metamorphosis of you as a person from a very, very young, you know, high school guy on those first records, and as it all changes. So, 1967, Jimmy Rogers records Child of Clay on A&M, and that's a number 31 hit that you end up doing later. And then it's a very, very busy time for you in the late 60s. The Hobbit's first album comes out in 67 on the Decca label, and it's kind of a mixture of sort of sunshine pop and soft psychedelia, and some people think it's a folk record. It's kind of, and it's a very, you know, clear, clean-sounding record. Very interesting. How did that group form, and how did you guys get to Decca?
The group was formed basically before I got involved with it. As I said before, I met this individual who already had three members of the group and was looking for a fourth, was basically looking for a songwriter, vocalist, lead singer. And when I came, he heard some of my demos and said, "You're the one, you're the person that I want, I've been looking for, because I have this concept in mind called The Hobbits. I even have the title of the album, Down to Middle Earth. And I want to, you know, put together 10, 12 songs and cut the album. I've already made a deal with Decca. They're on board. They're ready. They're ready to pay for the album." And that's what happened. I met the other three people that were going to be in the group. And basically, we were going to be a studio group. We went in. We had some magnificent musicians playing on that album. And we did the album. Decca loved it, and it went out. Never became a really big hit, but it had some regional popularity to it. If you listen to the album at that particular time, the album is you know, the sound of the album is really terrific.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. There's a great song on it that you wrote called "I'm Just a Young Man." Again, very, very 1967, kind of the... Were you feeling the generation gap personally at that time?
No, that was just a song. Basically, I wrote that song when I was at Laurie. And when this individual heard it, he said, "I want that song on the album, on the Hobbits album."
Yeah, there's some great, I don't know if you've seen it recently, but on the internet you can find the Hobbits over at the Bitter End Cafe performing live. And it's really quite an interesting group. Did you guys play in front of audiences much? Because you said it was mostly a studio group.
Basically a studio group. We did travel and did interviews at various TV stations, radio stations. We even auditioned for the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. We had a, you know, a little different kind of approach to, you know, how we would appear. We entered on roller skates. And then performed you know, whatever song we were going to sing.
That's amazing. But you guys very quickly recorded a second record. Is the title of the record "Men Indoors" or is it "Men Indoors: The Hobbits Communicate"?
Both.
It's both. Okay.
It's one of the albums that has two titles to it.
Yeah, I couldn't.
"Men Indoors" and "The Hobbits Communicate."
Your song "Artificial Face" for me is the standout of the record, and like you said, another fantastic sounding record. Just the way the record is recorded it still sounds really fresh today. Again, was this recorded in New York City?
Yes, it was recorded in New York City. I think it was recorded in A1 Studios. I think off of 7th Avenue. The president of the company had gone to Spain, and he got enamored with the Spanish guitar, and that's why you have a Spanish flavor in that album.
Yeah, the record jacket sort of talks about this special guest on Spanish guitar. I was always wondering why. Yeah, and that's so funny that the record.
I never understood it. I had told the producer that it didn't make any sense. Since the first Hobbit album was kind of a success, we should continue in that vein and just do the same kind of song, same kind of arrangements, just to build up the reputation of the group, the reputation of how the group sounds. I just wanted the Hobbits to continue the way the first album was.
Well, Decca Records, not not a huge label for rock and roll. And so I wonder if, you know, if they did not think maybe we'll just put some younger guys together and we'll try to sort of cash in on this kind of hippie psychedelic folk. They didn't even know what, you know, rock and roll. They just kind of threw some, you know, materials at it, and the covers look kind of vaguely psychedelic and 60s-ish. And it just makes me wonder did they care about the music at all, or was it just they're trying to package something together to sell? It's hard to know.
Yeah, I don't think Decca knew what they were all about. They were trying to find themselves as a record company, and I don't think they ever did. But, you know, they stuck with us for three albums, and like I said, the group broke up. And then I did my solo album.
Yeah. Well, during this time, are you, I don't know about your personal life. Were you raising a family? Were you making enough money off of music to live? What was your life during that time?
When I left advertising, I remember the day I left advertising, went to Laurie Records, sat down, started to write songs, and came home and said to my wife, I'm not in advertising anymore. And we had a 2-year-old boy, and she said, you couldn't have done this before I got pregnant. And I said, that, you know, life is strange. Yeah. Life takes some crazy turns. So that's how that happened. Yes, I had a son. I eventually had two sons, and I went, you know, through what I went through. Eventually, after my album, there was no opportunity for me at the company to record a second album.
So you mentioned that you became part of Perception. Was this and I'm not clear, is it a company that you owned or just worked at, or what was your connection?
Oh, I was senior vice president and creative director.
Gotcha. And so you're involved in a lot of records in the next few years that have something to do with the Perception label. And their biggest hit, I guess, comes with Dancing in the Moonlight from King Harvest in 1972, which was just a giant, giant song. I think that's how most people might know that label. But you had your name on a lot of songs: Waterproof, Tinker Toy, Groovy Girl, and the Sweet Bippies, which we heard earlier, Bubblegum Music, 1968, which is a song very similar to the Bumblebee Tuna jingle that I think you wrote later on. How did Bubblegum Music, again, this is yet another phase of music that you get involved with. How did you get involved with Bubblegum?
Well, you know, what happens is you write a pop song, and then you make it a really pop, beyond pop. What's beyond pop? Bubblegum. That is beyond pop. That's like a piece of apple pie, and now you throw on some vanilla ice cream. So, it's double pop song.
And did someone ask you to do this, or was it just a market that you saw open?
No. I was writing with this particular individual, and we just came up with that. That was it.
And how do songs like that find their way to a group like the Sweet Bippies?
That was, you know, that was just a studio, it wasn't even a studio group. I think I was the lead vocal on it with some background. And at that time, on TV, there was a show, I forget the name of the show, and there was a term called the Sweet Bippies, and we just used it as the name of the group.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very catchy song. So you're involved in a lot of records. This group Bag, this group Velvet Night on Metro Media. Bag is on Decca, the John Bartel thing on Capitol, and these are all sort of different, again, they're all different different genres of music. And then your solo record, Life, comes out, 1968. It's a very, very interesting sounding record. It's the way it's arranged and the instrumentation and the song, you know, the subject matter of the song, very interesting. What led you to record Life?
I was given an opportunity to record an album, And I put together a bunch of songs that I liked that I wanted to record. And that's how it happened. Went into the studio, recorded the songs.
We heard Francesca from the record earlier. Is that your wife that you spoke? Is that a song about her that you spoke about her earlier?
No, Francesca was the girlfriend of the person I wrote the song with. And at that time, after the song was given to a recording artist. His name escapes me, but he was a fairly big recording artist, and there was one line in the song that he disagreed with. He wouldn't record the song. He wanted to record it, but he wouldn't record it if that particular line stayed in the song, and it had to do with her staying overnight with this individual. And we said, no, we're not going to change it. That's the song. That's the lyric. And so he never did record the song. But I did.
Let me remind everybody, we're talking to Jimmy Curtis, and all of these records, they're out there. Some of them are harder to find, but there's some great music. Do you have a website? Because I found a website, but it's not one that you run. Is there a website or a page that listeners could visit if they wanted more information on you?
No, I don't have a website. Hard to believe in this day and age.
Yes, it wouldn't be the worst idea. Just for folks to get in touch with you and stuff. But good for you, I guess. It's just another headache maybe you don't need. Late 1960s, your solo records come out, and all those productions I mentioned earlier, and the new Hobbits, and there's just you seem to be a very busy guy. There's a record from Changing Colors. That has this sort of very, like you said, it's all about that catchy hooks, that da-da-da that's kind of, sped up. And is this you singing, or is this an actual group? I can't tell.
I remember the title of the song, but that's all I remember.
It's da-da-da. It has that very high-pitched da-da-da. So you were just making so many things you can't even remember them.
Yeah, there are things I can't remember. I remember the title. Changing Colors, whatever the song is, na-na-na, whatever it is. I remember that, but there are songs that I just don't remember.
Amazing. What about The Good Ship Lollipop and the song Girl on the Subway, which came out in Metromedia in 1969?
Girl on the Subway, I remember.
It has like a kind of a fuzz guitar hook, Again, very top 40 friendly, you would think, for that time.
Yeah. I remember Girl on the Subway because it was done by, I think, Shondell.
Good Ship Lollipop, is that, I don't know if these are real bands or who these are, but...
I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't remember that song.
Amazing. Was it frustrating that, to me, a lot of these songs are very, like you said, they're very catchy, they're very in the contemporary of what was going on in the 60s, but none of them were huge hits. Was that tough for you?
Well, it was, everybody wants a number one hit, but it's so difficult, so... It's a very difficult thing. Yeah, I would have wanted it. I would have wanted to, of course, to be a top 10 writer, a top 5 writer, but it didn't work out that way. I wasn't, terribly disappointed. I had a lot of success in advertising. I had a lot of success in writing songs for advertisers.
I mentioned earlier that one of your records sounded like the Bumblebee Tuna song. Did indeed you write that Bumblebee Tuna song that I think everyone in the world knows?
Yeah, that was something that because the song Bubblegum Music didn't do anything, didn't go anywhere, was barely in anybody's thought process. I decided when the opportunity came for the advertising agency to ask me to write something for Bumblebee Tuna, I said that fits just perfectly, and that's what I did. But I also wrote for Ford Motor Company. I also wrote for a bunch of different advertisers.
So that's that's what you did sort of from the mid-70s on, although you did dabble in music, but it seemed like you you did work mostly as a designer, a graphic designer and a music writer for jingles and stuff. And is that accurate to say that you kind of mostly moved out of the music industry after 74, 75?
Yeah, well, you know, what happened was I was not happy at Perception. I was not a happy camper, and I could not really do the things that I wanted to do. And so I decided that I would go into my own business with two other people and concentrate just on writing for advertisers. And I'm perfect for it because I write a lyric that is mostly a chorus.
After you sort of dropped out of the music industry and moved more to advertising, did that satisfy your creative soul?
Well, it never does any creative person. A creative person is never satisfied. Like I said before, a creative person can never have all their songs recorded. Never, ever.
So are there drawers of Jimmy Curtis songs that...
I've got a couple of hundred songs.
So all in all, I mean, you've had so many projects that you've had a hand in on so many different labels. I mean, do you think you're a guy who got your share of breaks? Are you lucky or are you unlucky that none of them became a giant success?
I was lucky when I started my own business because I made my own decisions every day. I was unlucky because I had met a couple of people in the music business from the beginning until I was in my own business that were not the nicest of people, were not the most honest of people. And for that reason, that part of my life, I wish I had met more upstanding, more people that would have taken more of an interest in my career rather than in theirs.
Yeah, well, I think that's the story of the music business and for so many people. Well, let's end this by playing Psychedelic Situation, which is kind of a mind-blowing record. I mean, I just absolutely love that record. Is there anything else you remember about it that you can tell us?
When it was reviewed in a music publication, the reviewer talked about how I must be on drugs. I must be whacked out of my mind to write this kind of a song. And the fact was that, no, I wasn't on drugs. I've never taken drugs. It was just thinking about what a person in a psychedelic situation would be thinking about. He would be thinking about some really strange things that have to do with his mother and that have to do with this and have to do with that. It was totally fabricated.
I was wondering that very thing. Well, Jimmy Curtis, it's been so interesting to catch up with you and hear some of the stories behind all these records.
Thank you, Michael, for being interested in me.
Colors shining bright. I can touch the rain on a sunny day. There's no one around, but I hear every word they say. I'm in a kind of new dimension, a kind of mind extension. Thank you.
writing "Love Me" on the ceiling. Out of the storm.